From the Sky News Centre at 5, there's another blow for the 1,700 workers at the Redcar Steelworks on Teesside as the owners liquidate their UK business. Barry Weir reports.
Devastating for the workers, for their families and the communities in Teesside.
That's one union's reaction. Workers had held on to the hope the mothballed site could reopen, but the liquidation of SSI UK means that's now unlikely. The Chancellor's promising £80 million to help workers.
To make sure people who need new training get the new training. Support businesses coming into the area.
The government insists it couldn't save the loss-making business, but Gareth Stance from trade body UK Steel says firms abroad do have an advantage.
We have costs that are piled onto us by UK government policy.
He says that needs to change.
A 15-year-old is beginning a life jail term after becoming the youngest person in the UK to ever admit terror offences. The boy will serve at least 5 years in prison for trying to persuade a man in Australia to kill police officers. Detective Chief Superintendent Tony Moll, who worked on the case, says the messages he sent revealed what the plan was.
Looking at potentially running a police officer over and possibly having a gunfight. Once we unlocked the encryption, we were talking to the Australians within a matter of hours.
The UK and the US have joined other countries in condemning Russia's recent airstrikes in Syria. In a statement, they say they have deep concern over the raids, which seem to have been targeting groups other than Islamic State. Radio presenter Neil Fox has pleaded not guilty to 6 new historical child sex offences. The 54-year-old's due in court next month on 7 separate charges of indecent assault, which he also denies. Doctors in Oregon say a number of those in hospital after yesterday's college shooting are expected to survive. 9 people died when a gunman opened fire. And Zach Goldsmith has been chosen as the Conservatives' candidate to run for London Mayor. He'll go up against Labour's Sadiq Khan in the vote next year. Goldsmith, the MP for Richmond Park, was backed by 70% of voters in an online primary. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
BCFM 93.2.
Stand by for action.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Green Councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as usual, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, in terms of materials and labour, basic 3-bedroom semi-detached house costs around £60,000 or £70,000 to build. If it sits there for 200 years, that works out about £12 a month. But many people, particularly in London, are paying 100 times that and more. So, apart from the usual bankster suspects, who's profiting from the housing racket, and why this obsession with pumping up the housing bubble? How did we get from the earth being a free gift to mankind to a price where tens of millions can't afford any of it? Around a million people in Britain today left homeless. Plus rumours and counter-rumours about Hinkley Point Power Station. What's happening to the waste from Hinkley A, which was decommissioned in 2000? Is Hinkley B still really a bomb factory, as we heard from Nicky Clark last week? And will Hinkley C ever be built? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 18 with sunny spells. Next week, highs of 18, showers at the beginning of the week, but sunnier, but feeling cooler from midweek on. And I didn't honestly think last week's forecast was going to be right, but it was. It was sunny all week, wasn't it? Next weekend, that's the 10th and 11th of October, highs of 16 Celsius, cooling down slowly, isn't it, into the autumn, and fairly sunny next weekend. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas. Hi, Jerome. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks, Tony, and thanks for inviting me this afternoon.
Well, you're welcome. And you're a brand new councillor, aren't you? And you just arrived, well, I say brand new, in May. Tell us a bit about what you did before you became a councillor. What brought you into politics?
Well, I've lived in Clifton Wood and Hotwells for over 20 years and tried to be actively involved in the community. Our children were all born there and have grown up there. And really it's about wanting to contribute to the community. I joined the Green Party because I share their vision, the Green Party vision of a sort of fairer, greener, more prosperous society.
Well, tell us about the involvement in the community. When you say I was involved in the community, what sort of stuff were you up to?
Setting up street parties in Clifton Wood, being an active parent at Cottam, those sorts of things.
And why Greens? Why not one of the other parties?
Well, I was a Labour Party member for 25 years and felt that the Labour Party wasn't nailing its colours to the mast properly with regards to the environment. A bit like the Tories, they might say that they're the greenest government ever, but when things are tough, they'll go back to what comes naturally to them. And even with Labour, when things get tough, they can quite easily forget about the environment and what a sort of better vision of a sort of greener society looks like. So I felt that in the Green Party there was an opportunity to be much clearer about that combination of a fairer society and a greener society, which has to be at the heart of the transformation that we need in society.
So Elise, what's your idea then anyway of the green vision for Bristol? We're in the European Green Capital Year. Do you think that's actually made much of a difference, or has it been a kind of superficial marketing exercise?
I think it's much deeper than that. I think it's really important in terms of trying to get a clearer picture of what it means to have a greener society. So whether that's combating climate change and having a low carbon society, or having a place where air quality is better and we can lead more active, healthier lifestyles.
Less dependence on the car, is that what you mean? Because there's plenty of people sitting out there now in their cars wishing, I suppose, that there were other ways to get around rather than sitting in a traffic jam.
That's obviously one part of it. I mean, the Greens get criticised for being excessively anti-car. It's about having the most appropriate forms of transport. Cars are often the most appropriate forms of transport. But, in a modern society, we need increasingly to live in cities. And in order to live happily in cities, the car has to play a lesser role and take second place to, walking, public transport, cycling, whatever the most appropriate form of transport
is. So are you over the moon about the Metro bus?
Not over the moon. I mean, I think we had to dance to the tune of the government in terms of what was on offer there, and I think it's been less than ideal in some ways, and it's been sad that tracts of good agricultural land have been lost in order to get it into place. But on the plus side, hopefully we'll get a lot of people out of cars and onto public transport, and help create a sort of more vibrant, greener, more prosperous city.
Well, so what with central government telling us what to do over things like public transport, and you as a councillor having very little power since the mayor has all the executive power, he makes all the decisions really, what's the point of being a councillor?
Well I think it's difficult. I think it's easy to overstate what the power of the mayor is. The councillors still have a considerable amount of power. In terms of my personal view on what that power is, you're obviously very connected into your communities and work hard to understand what's going on and to make a difference there. And what I think we also find with the mayor is that you get a broad vision for the city, but actually when it comes to individual policy areas, you're not getting that much detail about what does it mean necessarily in housing, energy, transport, food, these areas. And I think part of the role of the councillors is to really spell out the extra detail so that we can get much better plans for the future of the city.
Well, you're talking about making a difference, but the mayor makes all the decisions.
No, not in legal terms. He doesn't. He's got the responsibility for setting the budget. But if 70% of councillors disagree with him, then they can reject the budget and they can put something else in place. So it's about that's and what that focuses us on as councillors is trying to build cross-party consensus for a sort of clear community-based vision for the city.
Well, what have you achieved, do you think, since May? That's something that you say, well, actually, I'm really glad I became a councillor, I've achieved this.
I've had some impact on the culture of openness, I would say. I think in terms of the what I've found is that there is a culture of excessive secrecy in the council. At times it's fairly superficial, and I think that we're beginning to make a difference there. I think we're beginning to spell out to the council, you know, where it's sensible to have secrecy, and where it's unacceptable and where it's really unhelpful for having the kind of open, transparent, accountable government that we want to see in the city, and to see standards increasingly raised.
So how do you decide when something's got to be kept quiet and confidential and when it should be open?
You really have to apply the public interest test in a more rigorous way, which is, does this really need to be kept secret, or does it? Is there a really good reason that the presumption should be that something should be in the open? If there are very sound commercial reasons, then it should stay in the private domain. But probably less than half of what is currently restricted needs to be.
Interesting, very interesting. Give us an idea of something that's been restricted in the past that you think shouldn't have been, which shows us how, you know, the council's actually using our money to keep things from us rather than to share things with us, which it should be doing.
I think in the case of the energy company that the council's launched, which I'm very strongly in favour of, I think that a lot of the information relating to the energy company and their planning was held back for really unnecessary reasons, and actually releasing some of the reports relating to that would have been helpful and would have improved the quality of public discussion around it.
And also the idea that you're trying to build a consensus around something doesn't work very well, Martin, with secrecy, doesn't it? I mean, we've had Daphne Havercroft and various other people on here over the last few years talking about an increasing amount of secrecy since Mayor George Ferguson arrived, with things like, things being kept from councillors when they've been saying we want to see this report. I mean, we've had this whole business with the arena, for example, where a lot of the plans to do with it, particularly the financial side of it, were being kept from councillors unnecessarily, and it looked as if they were being asked to sign up to something. I'm talking about the councillors here, that they hadn't actually been able to properly scrutinise.
Well, I think it's very strange that when, as the private sector has become more and more involved in the provision of public services, both locally and nationally, that we get this commercial confidentiality being wheeled out. So we've actually got, you know, certainly at national government level, lots of deals that have been done are not actually in the public domain because they're commercially confidential. And I would actually argue that in that case, there's no, you can't have commercially confidential deals done with public money. Public money has to be openly spent. And that's why, of course, many of these things in the past used to be done by the public sector and were, you know, with all of the scrutiny that involves. Whereas once you start contracting out, the argument that, you know, the commercial aspects of what's going on are commercially sensitive and therefore the public isn't allowed to know, I would argue that that's wrong in principle.
We've had a couple of things, haven't we? Recently, we've had the mayor standing and winning as an independent whilst being a merchant venturer, and then he gave up his membership of the merchant venturers. But then the merchant venturers decided they might invite him back from time to time since he was the mayor. And then we've had recently this revelation about Stephen Robertson, the chairman of Business West, being the partner at Sue Mount Stevens, who declared herself as an independent as a police and crime commissioner. I just wonder what we think, Jerome, about this idea of independents, who aren't necessarily quite what they seem, because the business lobby is quite strong out there and it seems to be behind both Sue and George.
I mean, I think there's two questions there, aren't there? I mean, one is the notion of independence, and then two is the question about how much people, how much power business in Bristol has. I think in terms of the question about independence, my personal view is that politics is really about operating as teams, and that means about working collectively, signing up to a party line, and then the electorate knows what it's getting that's associated with your party, and on one level that's your brand, and I, you know, I very much enjoy being part of a team, and I think in terms of business and what the power of business is in the city, I haven't seen a huge amount of business influence compared to what was described in the 20 or 30 years ago. And I think when it comes to the influence of organisations like the merchant venturers, my feel is that they're starting to move with the times. And when it comes to something that matters, for example, such as opening up the downs for kids to cycle there at weekends and making it traffic free, they will go with the flow and they will be flexible. But I'm also very happy to have examples pointed out of where business has got excessive power and wealth.
Well, you say moving with the times. I mean, taking over secondary schools, several secondary schools now run by merchant venturers, and also a lot of youth work now. Merchant venturers have had a big influence in setting up companies that are now managing a lot of young people's activities. So, Martin, this is a fascinating site. It's almost like the business party is another party all of its own, probably quite allied to the Tory party, but it's hovering around outside politics, a little bit scared to show its face.
Well, I think there is a question to be asked about whether what are essentially, private commercial organisations, although they claim to have wider goals, should be in charge of running schools. I mean, frankly, I work in a school, I work in an academy, and it's not a bad place to work. But I think the local authority schools with actual accountability and control was the best system. I mean, I'm a bit of a dinosaur. I actually believe in the public sector and the public sector ethos. And once you actually have a lot of non-public organisations organising public, using public funds, there are questions to be asked about that.
Do you think
that's the way to go? And
do you think
I don't think it is.
Where this ethos of secrecy comes from, Jerome, perhaps? Because that certainly is worrying. If you think about, the budget, I think, here in Bristol is something around, isn't it about £370 million a year of our money being spent? We want to know how it's being spent and why it's being spent like that.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily... I mean, I think it's taking some of those... some of the worst facets of business. I think modern business can have a much more progressive agenda in some ways. I mean, if, for example, you look at business in the US at the moment, you look at big business in the US, it's taking a far more progressive approach on carbon emissions and climate change than Congress has been able to. And actually, a lot of the force for change around climate change in the US is coming from big business. So I'm much more of the mind that a healthy combination of business and government, it's good. They both keep each other honest. And I think if you look at something, for example, like the East Coast Railway line, I think that was an awful example of... what happened in that case was that the original private sector contractor failed on the East Coast line, handed it back to the government. The government then ran that line more profitably and better than any of the other private rail contractors. And then, for ideological reasons, it's been put back into the private sector. And what I would like to see is, a healthy combination of private sector and public sector, with each being allowed to contribute on its own merit.
Yes, the railways is an interesting one. Martin brings up regularly the New Zealand situation where this triggered a kind of split in the left in New Zealand. But anyway, let's go now to, and I must admit, Martin, when I was listening to this, I was thinking of you, John McDonnell's speech at the Labour Party conference this week, and he starts off actually by talking about George Osborne and his attitude to selling off public assets like the railways. So let's have a listen now to John McDonnell as the Shadow Chancellor.
I found the Conservatives' rant against Jeremy's proposal to bring rail back into public ownership absolutely ironic. When George Osborne was touring China, selling off to the Chinese State Bank any British asset he could lay his hands on. It seems the state nationalising our assets is okay with the Tories, as long as it's Chinese State Bank, or in the case of the railways, the Dutch or the French. Institutional change will follow and has to reflect our policy change. So I want us to stand back and review the major institutions that are charged with managing our economy to check that they're fit for purpose and how they can be made more effective. So as a start, I've invited Lord Bob Kerslake, former head of the civil service, to bring together a team to review the operation of the Treasury itself. I'll also be setting up a... I thought that would go down well. I'll also be setting up a review of the Bank of England. Let me be clear, we will guarantee independence, the independence of the Bank of England. But it's time, though, to open up the debate on the bank's mandate that was set by Parliament 18 years ago. The mandate focuses on inflation, and even then, the bank regularly fails to meet its target. We will launch a debate on expanding that mandate to include new objectives, including growth, employment, and earnings as well. We'll review the operation and resourcing of Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs to ensure that HMRC is capable of addressing tax evasion and avoidance and modernising our tax collection system.
Well, I mean, he wasn't just talking about the railways there, obviously, although they do have a very symbolic role. As I frequently say on this show, in New Zealand, the privatisation of the railways by the Labour government led to the split in the Labour Party in New Zealand. But we'll put that on one side for a moment. I mean, in general, I think that's a pretty good start by John McDonald. There's a long way to go to flesh that out.
But he's talking about three interesting things there. He's saying they're going to completely review the role of the Treasury. They're looking also at the Bank of England. Now, this obsession with interest rates, I mean, keeping them low. Well, they seem to have done quite well at that. In fact, keeping them around about zero. But everything else seems to have been lost. And he's saying, well, what actually the Bank of England should be doing is looking at more.
Simon Wren-Lewis, who I raise, who is an Oxford economist currently based at Oxford University, he's not in favour of the Bank of England losing its independence, because in actual fact the mandate of the Bank of England can be set by the government of the day. And I think that's what McDonald is saying there, because of course in the past the Bank of England was literally part of the government machine, and the government could decide to tell the Bank of England to do what it wanted to do, very different from the Federal Reserve in the US, which is essentially owned by the private sector. But I think what he's done there is he's triangulated. Some people wanted the Bank of England to be brought back under the control of the government. He's saying he's not going to do that, but he is going to look at what the mandate is, because they tend to take basically the views of the city as too much into account. Although they are a nationalised bank, unlike the Federal Reserve in the US, they are basically too close to the City of London, is what he's hinting there, and he's suggesting that he's going to look into that and try and change it.
Well, Green Councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas, what are your thoughts about the what has been laid out this week, particularly by the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell?
I mean, I think it's, you know, healthy, positive stuff that Greens could mostly agree with. I mean, I think in terms of focusing on growth in our economy, we want to make sure that's the benefits of growth and economic activity properly and fairly spread.
But doesn't growth destroy the climate? The more growth you have, doesn't it sort of mean more pollution and that kind of thing?
What we need to focus on is increasing the low carbon component of the economy, so that you can remove that link between growing and carbon emissions. And what we really want to focus on is you know, what we call the circular economy, which is recognising that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. I take fishing as the example. You can't grow your fish catches, because before too long the sea gets emptied of fish stock, and you need to manage your fish stock, and you need to think about the competing requirements. You've got off the south coast of England, I think it's one Dutch company who's got 95% of the fish quota, and similarly in Scotland you've got very large businesses that have got huge entitlement to what should belong to everybody. And so if you take fishing as an example of the economy, you need to look at that managed framework for the environment and for managing it for people and for nature, so that we can have a sort of much more balanced approach.
This idea of growth, Martin, have we got to the point where we shouldn't be looking for growth because it's actually not good for us, not good for the environment, or is it Jerome Wright, we should be looking at how we grow?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, we've got to understand what we mean by growth. We don't want more growth, which is essentially energy intensive, not just carbon intensive, energy intensive. We need to actually, and we, the technology is there for us to consume an awful lot less energy than we do. That's the solution to an awful lot of our problems.
Well, one thing that is growing, of course, is the national debt. It's doing quite well, isn't it? It's now, is it 1.2, 1.3 trillion?
Well, yes, but that's another. That's more in the mainstream macroeconomic field. But I think there's a wide consensus amongst progressive economists that growth does not have to be destructive of the environment, provided it's the right kind of growth and taking into account all of the things that Jerome's just outlined. And I think there's a general view amongst progressive economists that sees these things as compatible, but potentially conflictual if you don't get it right.
A bit like the wrong kind of leaves on the line, is that?
Well, yes, I suppose so. if you want to separate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've got to get this sort of balance right between growth and almost rationing that we've got to look at as we move forward as a society. Yeah. That sense of growth as our priority felt all well and good when you weren't running into all kinds of natural constraints. But actually, you take the fish example, you need more to ration than you do to focus on what growth is, because that growth is not possible. And then that brings in the questions of, well, if you're going to ration, then it has to be fair. So as we move forward as a country and globally, that sense of who gets what share of the pie becomes much more important than when there aren't those limits.
But I mean,
growth.
Surely our original fish quotas and things were due to the Royal Navy shooting Dutch ships, weren't they? And you know, how do you go from that to a fair system in the EU? I mean, do you think the EU's done a decent job with fishing?
I think it's improved over the last few years. I mean, I think the Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall campaign was very effective for actually changing EU policy. I think the EU policy has got more sensible, but we also need to be looking at things much more on a global level, and look at those issues of fairness on a global level.
Okay, back to the Labour conference, and it was fascinating actually to see that. I felt I was amazed actually, because we did a special last Friday about vote fraud and problems with the voting system across Britain, all sorts of different aspects of that, really ending up with six different ways to fix a British election. And you can find that on YouTube if you want. It's doing quite well already, that one, which is really just looking at some of the big flaws there are in our electoral system and how they're being exploited by some parties. And they've been exploited in Tower Hamlets particularly, where the mayor of Tower Hamlets was kicked out for fixing postal ballots. But this came up in Jeremy Corbyn, the new Labour leader's conference speech this week. So let's have a listen to him talking about gerrymandering.
Just before Parliament rose for the summer, the Tories sneaked out a plan to strike millions of people off the electoral register this December. Very clever. A year earlier than the Independent Electoral Commission had advised them to do. What it means is this. Listen carefully. 2 million people could lose their right to vote. That's 400,000 in London, 70,000 in Glasgow, thousands, every town, city, village and hamlet all across the country. Overwhelmingly, they're students, they're people in insecure accommodation, short-stay private lets. We know why the Tories are doing it. They want to gerrymander next year's mayoral election in London by denying hundreds of thousands of Londoners their right to vote. They want to do the same for the Assembly elections in Wales, and they want to gerrymander electoral boundaries across the whole country by ensuring the new reduced House of Commons boundaries will be decided on the basis of the missing millions from the voters' register when the Boundary Commission starts its work next April. So, conference, we've got to do our best to stop them. We'll highlight the issue in Parliament, of course, and outside. We'll work with councils all across the country to get people back on the register. But I make this appeal to you. From today, from now, our party, our Labour Party, starts a nationwide campaign for all our members to work in every town and city, every university, as students start the new term, to stop the Tory gerrymandering to get people on the electoral register. I know this is hard work, but before I became an MP, I was agent in Hornsey constituency for 10 years, and I know how hard and vital that work is. And we're going to do it. But these days, we've got new resources. The power of social media, the power of our huge membership conference. Let's get to it and get those people on the register to give us those victories, but also to get fairness within our society.
Well, I welcome him saying that, although when Jeremy Corbyn came to Bristol, I did ask him about what his view on PR was. And what he said was that he's in favour of a commission to look into the whole of the constitution, but he said in general he's not convinced of the case for PR. Now I think what he's pointing out is what's going to happen is that the existing electoral registers, which we know to be incomplete, less people voted in Bristol West this time than last time, even though the population has increased, and this is because it's become an obstacle course to get to register to vote. And in actual fact, we know what happens in the US is that poor marginalised people who move a lot, are basically excluded from the electoral register. So they're moving back towards a household-based register. Only those people who have a stable address, a stable place in society, bother to vote or bother to be chased up. But I think the most pernicious thing that the government is doing is to redraw the electoral boundaries on the basis of incomplete registers, which is gerrymandering. And I'm glad he's picked up on that, but I'm still not happy with his position on PR. I think he needs to be bolder on that.
Jerome, what do you make of this? What does the Green Party think about this? Is it fair to use the term gerrymandering?
Yeah, I agree entirely with Martin. I mean, I think the challenge is that you've always got to work with the election system that is there. So, I think that the opposition parties did have the benefits that the electoral planned redrawing of the electoral boundaries that was supposed to happen for the last election didn't happen because the Lib Dems vetoed it. And that would have given an extra 20 seats or so to the Conservatives. So we've got that to deal with as well.
Well, that's worrying, isn't it? If a government who's in power is worried about losing the next election, so they change the boundaries to make sure they stay in, that's not democracy.
It's not democracy, I don't know what the role of the electoral commission is, but clearly they've got an important role as an independent body.
Now the steel crisis. This is maybe we'll have your comments first, Martin, on this. You talking about growth, and yet there's a massive steel plant in Middlesbrough which has been there for generations, just closing. Is this just inevitable that we're going to see this deindustrialisation continue, which started in the 1980s, effectively slow deindustrialisation of the north? The other side of this, of course, is it's sold off to a Thai company, and one of the things that's not been really talked much about this is the whole Thai company is completely in the control of the banks. It's a big multinational bank that's told this Thai company, no, you're going to have to close a steel plant down.
Well, yes. I mean, the economic crisis has not gone away. And the idea that Britain is on the path to recovery with a long-term economic plan is frankly laughable.
What role does steel play? And it's an indicator, an economic indicator, Martin.
Well, in the five-year plans that the Soviet Union used to have and the Chinese used to have, that the production of steel was regarded as a sign of virility. But, I mean, it is a key component, for example, of things like windmills and other modern renewable technologies. So I think what's actually happening is we're seeing a collapse of commodity prices and of industrial materials like steel. The real economy is starting to falter, even as the stock market, is still riding high.
Isn't it just that the Germans can do this more efficiently, cheaper than us?
Well, there's bound to be arbitrage between certain countries. I mean, it makes sense for lower income countries to do the sorts of things we used to do, and for us to move on to different, to do things with the steel, as it were, rather than to produce the raw material. But I think the deindustrialisation of Britain over the last 30 and 40 years has been largely gratuitous. I mean, in Norway, they've increased manufacturing employment while manufacturing employment in Britain has collapsed. How did they do that? Well, they did it by having an industrial policy, something which is off limits to the people who run the show in Britain.
OK, we'll hear a clip now from Jeremy Corbyn's speech again on this, and we'll hear from Jerome after we've heard that.
There's an investment crisis. There's a big investment crisis in Britain. We're at the bottom of the international league table. Well, not quite just at the bottom. We're just below Madagascar and just above El Salvador. So we're doing quite well. And we have a balance of payments deficit of £100 billion last year, loading our economy and every one of us with unsustainable debt for the future. And the shocks in the world markets this summer have shown what a dangerous and fragile state the world economy is in, and how ill-prepared the Tories have left us to face another crisis. It hasn't been growing exports and a stronger manufacturing sector that have underpinned the feeble economic recovery. The only thing is house price inflation, asset inflation, more private debt. We have an economy that's unbalanced, unsustainable, and frankly dangerous to the security of people of this country. That's the real risk to us all. And think of the people who've had to stretch to take on mortgages. People have only been able to keep their families afloat by relying on credit cards and payday loans, fearful of how they will cope with a rise in interest rates. It's not acceptable. The Tories' austerity is the outdated and utterly failed approach of the past. So it's for us. It's for us. For Labour to develop our forward-looking alternative. That's what John McDonnell started to do in his excellent speech to conference yesterday. At the heart of it is investing for the future. Every mainstream economist will tell you that with interest rates so low, now is the time for public investment in our infrastructure. Investment in council housing and for affordable homes and to rent and to buy. John Healey's plan for 100,000 new council and housing association homes a year to tackle the housing crisis, drive down the spiralling housing benefit bill, and so actually make a profit for the taxpayer. A profit for the taxpayer because the benefit bill falls when the cost of housing falls. It's quite simple, actually, and quite a good idea.
Yep, I agree entirely with that.
So you're going to rejoin... are you going to rejoin the Labour Party?
No, I mean, I think we saw when the Labour Party discussions around Trident that, you know, a lot of the Labour Party MPs are supporting Trident because the trade union wants those jobs. You know, and the trade unions have been quite happy with jobs in armaments because they provide jobs as well. And we have to have a much clearer vision of what kind of economy we actually want. And it's not about the kind of metal bashing and the exports that would have been much more relevant for us in the 1950s and 60s. All across the world, countries are trying to export their way out of the problems that they've got, and it's a zero-sum game. And where I do agree with what Jeremy Corbyn was saying there was, in terms, if you take something like housing, it's a great place to be investing as a society. But what Labour doesn't talk about is localising our economies and trying to increase the sort of the local component in our economies, whether it's, you know, locally produced food or entertainment or more sustainable forms of travel. And it's a greater focus on the local economy that creates those kind of happier working relationships, stronger sense of knowing the people that you're interacting with on an economic basis. And Labour's doesn't really have that kind of vision of an economy. It's got very much a sort of statist vision. And Labour, when it was in power, was very much working with the kind of big businesses that the Tories are equally happy with. So that's where the Greens have a distinctive economic approach that's very much different from Labour.
Well, Labour's maybe changing, but anyway, Martin can answer that after we've heard a bit, because you mentioned Trident, and so did Jeremy Corbyn.
But there's one thing I want to make my own position on absolutely clear, and I believe I have a mandate from my election on it. I don't believe that £100 billion spent on a new generation of nuclear weapons, taking up a quarter of our defence budget, is the right way forward. I believe that our country should honour our obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and take a lead in making progress towards international nuclear disarmament.
Well, I agree with that, but unfortunately the GMB in particular doesn't. They'll have to be convinced. But I think if there is going to be another economic crisis, and I think there is, then we're going to have to seriously discuss what we are prepared to spend our money on, and that amount of money spent on a weapon that we will never use. There's no circumstances in which we would ever use it. But the only circumstances in which I think we might use it, if we tried to break out of NATO and the Americans were threatening us, we could then point it at them. But in any case, it's been designed not to do that. So in that case, it's got no conceivable use.
It's not really an independent nuclear deterrent,
exactly.
Is it?
So what good is it?
Jerome, what do you make of this whole Trident business? Will you be for it, against it, or what?
I'm opposed to Trident. I can't see any reason why it's relevant to our modern needs.
I mean, it's said that it's kept the peace for the last 70 years. I mean, since the Nagasaki Hiroshima bombs were dropped.
You know, we could argue about that, but I think looking forward, it's got no role.
Well, I agree with that, and I think in actual fact, what it is, if we gave it up, I mean, South Africa gave up its nuclear weapons, or there's a story about what happened to the actual warheads. We could actually gain more traction and credibility in the world by giving up nuclear weapons than by keeping them. But of course, the old thing in the Foreign Office is if we give up our nuclear weapons, the French will keep their role on the Security Council and we will be downgraded and so on. But it probably is time to reform the UN Security Council, and us giving up our nuclear weapons could be part of a push to do exactly that.
At the end of his speech, Jeremy Corbyn was talking about Keir Hardie, the bearded Scotsman that started, one of them anyway, that started the Labour Party.
The last bearded man to lead the Labour Party was a wonderful, great Scotsman, Keir Hardie. Who died a century ago this weekend, and we commemorated him with a book we launched on Sunday evening. Keir grew up in dreadful poverty and made so much of his life and founded our party, stood up to be counted on Votes for Women, stood up for social justice, stood up to develop our political party. We owe him and so many more so much. And he kind of was asked once, summarise what you're about. Keir, summarise what you really mean in your life. And he thought for a moment, and he said this: my work has consisted of trying to stir up divine discontent with wrong. What words they are, what brilliance. So I say to you, don't accept injustice. Stand up against prejudice. Let us build a kinder politics, a more caring society, together. Let's put our values, the people's values, back into politics. Conference, thank you.
Well, another standing ovation and applause for Corbyn. Martin, he's started to lay out some of these policies, hasn't he, now? I mean, we got a speech when he was first elected a few weeks ago. What do you make of the direction he's now taking the Labour Party?
Well, I'm broadly in favour of it. My main discontent, as I said earlier, is his unwillingness to consider changing the electoral system. I think that would be...
Well, the public voted on that, didn't they, in 2010, five years ago, and they said they didn't want it.
Yeah, so, but that was because the Liberals foolishly went into government with the Tories and allowed the whole thing to be spiked.
The fact
of the matter is, Tony, that on the other side of the Severn Bridge in Wales, we've already got a different electoral system, and it does lead to a different kind of politics. We've got a different electoral electoral system in Scotland, which has led to a different kind of politics. And above all, we've got a different electoral system in Northern Ireland, because there was a flipping civil war in which 3,000 odd people died in order to change the arrangements over there to make sure everybody got a fair crack of the whip. It's not actually something... It's the current electoral system, and I'm sure Jeremy will agree with me, is not fit for purpose. We are facing the biggest geopolitical and economic crisis of the 21st century, and we have basically got an electoral system with the House of Lords. The big British House of Lords is the biggest chamber in the world, apart from the Chinese People's Congress. It's absolutely packed with placemen, and that is why all of that history weighs down upon Britain. It's what Marx said, you know, the traditions of the dead generations weigh like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And if I make my plug again for what happened in New Zealand in the early 1980s, a right-wing Labour government came to power, determined to pursue Thatcherite policies, including the privatisation of the railways. There was a rebellion by the trade union activists and by the Labour activists, and the way that rebellion went is they forced a PR referendum to change the whole setup. And then, as a result of that, a left-wing Labour government came to power, supported by the Greens and the Maori nationalists, and set a new direction. And what happens in New Zealand politics actually happens in British politics with a time lag. They gave Britain, they gave women the vote in New Zealand in the 1880s.
Well, that's
50 years before we did it in Britain.
If the Conservative Party and the public give it a chance to. Another story this week, Kerry McCarthy, who's our local MP here, Bristol West, is it? No, yes, Bristol East. She's now Shadow Environment Secretary, but she's been in the news because of talking about being a vegan. People are worried, apparently, by her veganism, but she does insist she supports British farming. Now, this is an interesting one, isn't it, Jerome, because there is a lot of evidence that there's a bit of an obsession with livestock farming and not enough arable farming going on, because it's not ultimately sustainable to keep rearing sheep and cattle all the time if we're going to actually feed ourselves as a country.
And by and large, it's much healthier to eat less meat. I think it's good for the economy. It's good for ourselves. I'm a meat eater, but I think that we will move increasingly towards a sort of sense of cruelty-free living. I think many of us found quite incongruous the sort of the uproar about the death of Cecil the Lion, compared to the amount of death that takes place as a result of meat eating.
What about? It's all very well being a vegetarian, but why be a vegan? I mean, you can. So Kerry won't have honey. I should ask her this, really, but or things like milk and products from animals. Martin, what do you make of this?
Well, that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do if people want to pursue. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn himself is a vegetarian, not a vegan. I'm a meat eater. I think, but I'd certainly agree that we've got to actually change our attitude towards food and health. It's one of the transitions that we have to make, isn't it?
Can you see why, though? Livestock farmers are thinking, well, this is nobody. She's not going to take us seriously if she gets into power.
Well, what I say to them is this, is that we shouldn't have a situation where the battery-produced chicken it undersells the organically produced chicken, which has been produced with consideration for animal cruelty and with a health concern. I mean, we're pumping animals full of antibiotics is probably leading to these MRSA scans and so on. So, I mean, we need to actually... And don't forget that virtually all agricultural production ultimately is subsidised. We think of it as a private sector exercise. It isn't really. The Common Agricultural Policy effectively is a government institution, and the USA is exactly the same. And the reason why governments actually intervene in food markets is because ultimately it's a matter of national independence and survival. During World War II, Britain had to grow its own food because the U-boat campaign was trying to starve us into submission. And that's true also of it, the third world countries. The big American multinationals like Cargill, I did PhD research on this at Glasgow some years ago, I didn't complete it, they actually go out of their way to destroy traditional farming techniques around the world so that they can then dominate the politics of the countries concerned. So Bangladesh, for example, gets loads and loads of subsidised US wheat dumped on them year after year, which of course leads to low, you know, undercutting the local producers. And then it means that when it comes to a tight vote in the UN about invading Iraq, the Bangladeshis are reminded in no uncertain terms who provides their food. And that is actually clear. That's it's been explicitly articulated by US political figures that is their goal. We've got to actually destroy other people's agricultural systems so that ours becomes dominant, which is what the Common Agricultural Policy was set up to prevent, because we'd all be eating American food.
It's not just agricultural systems, it's destroying in places like Libya and Syria.
Well, no, it's not. But I mean, there's a long-term plan to industrialise the world on their terms and destroy traditional ways of life, which can be upgraded. There's no reason why traditional farming techniques, as for example in Poland where I used to live, it looks very inefficient. But in actual fact, Polish farming, if there was a level playing field, could compete. But there isn't a level playing field, and there's never going to be.
The Green Party's Darren Hall is backing George Ferguson to win a second term as Bristol Mayor. This was echoes of this a few weeks ago. Anyway, I mean, I don't know if this is true. Maybe you can enlighten us, Jerome, as to whether this is true. Someone from the Green Party actually saying that they want the independent George Ferguson to be our next mayor. We have an election at the beginning of next year.
My understanding is this is a bit of a recycled story, and that I think Darren made a comment on this 3 or 4 weeks ago, but has subsequently said that his first choice would be for a Green candidate for mayor and a second for George.
You know what? I also look at the. I mean, that story is from about 3 or 4 weeks ago. But and I look on the again almost every time you open the Bristol Post, it's got a sort of flag waving story about how wonderful George Ferguson is, and even manufacturing stories about people from other parties actually supporting him. This week, it's George Ferguson is in pole position, like some kind of Jackie Stewart, you know, at the start of the racing grid to be Bristol mayor. Again, always looking at the betting odds, apparently George Ferguson is at 1-3, and everyone else is way. Well, actually, next is Marvin Rees, no surprise there, as he was number 2 last time at 3-1. But what are we getting from the Bristol Post, just generally, from you as a councillor? Because this to me looks really biased. You know, we've got a story, first of all, saying that Darren Hall is going to vote for George Ferguson, which Darren himself is then denying. And then we've got a splash saying, oh, George Ferguson's pole position, he's going to be Bristol Mayor again.
Sounds like he's quite popular with the Bristol Post then, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, as we know, the Bristol Post tends to be in favour of George Ferguson's. They basically campaigned for him, and that's fair enough.
We've all got to be clear that's what's going on. This business community, aren't they, that we were talking about earlier? This sort of third party hovering around politics in the city. Also, we've had this week the Lib Dem mayoral candidate. We should have a referendum to decide if we want a Bristol mayor. Lib Dem mayor candidate Kay Barnard has promised a referendum on whether Bristol wants to continue with an elected mayor. If she's elected to the post next May, Dr. Barnard, who was born in Bristol and has a background in scientific research, was chosen as the party's candidate in an event at the weekend. Which way would you vote, Jerome, if this did happen? I know it's apparently manoeuvring its way, courtesy of Baroness Jank, through the House of Lords at the moment.
The Green Party's preference is not to have elected mayors.
Why is that?
Because it felt that there's an unnecessary level of centralisation of power. That takes place with the mayor, and I think we've seen some of that with the current mayoral system, but it's also early days, and I hope we as a group of councillors can do something to redress the balance, whether there is or isn't an elected mayor in the future.
Why are we in a situation, Martin, where Bristol's one of the only cities in the country which has been told, well, you voted for a mayor and now you're not allowed to go back?
Well, as you know, Tony, I was always opposed to having a mayor. And if you think about it, the referendum in which we elected, decided to change the system, it was a turnout of 30%, of which less than just about half voted for it. Now, when we said that the Northern Ireland Peace Agreement or the Scottish Independence Referendum, it's got to be 50% plus one to go through a big change like this. And it was really, it's been foisted on Bristol without a real mandate. And I think that's been the real problem for George Ferguson, is that his mandate is effectively quite weak. I mean, the mayoral system itself wasn't really supported overwhelmingly, and then when he won the election, it was only by a little bit, and on a 30% turnout. So you know, less than 2 in 10 of people of Bristol supported George Ferguson to be all powerful. Now, if you're voting for a local councillor, that's not so dramatically problematic, because you can always, you know, you can always get another one. But as a mayor with like a CEO of a huge organisation, I just think it's too concentrated. The power's too concentrated. I agree with Jerome, and of course, there was a split in the Labour Party about this. Some agreed with me, and some didn't.
The daggers drawn and knives stuck in people's backs, no doubt. On Tuesday, Panorama's showing a programme called The VIP Paedophile Ring, What's the Truth? Starting around about 10:30 on BBC One. First of all, looking at this really disturbs me with the title, What's the Truth? The BBC Panorama telling us what's the truth. The other side of this story is we've got... John Mann MP, I have a little clip from him now talking about this in Parliament not long after the Parliament started sitting earlier this year about this particular story. So let's have a quick listen to John Mann, and then I'll explain why I'm so concerned about this, particularly because Panorama in the 1980s were given a massive dossier which they then, it seems, lost, rather like the Home Office did.
But there's one other issue that the new members need to be aware of, because it's going to haunt this Parliament. And Esther, yesterday on Sky Television, outlined it bravely, and I've been in touch with her today, where she's gone to the police with a Member of Parliament that she and now a number of others are alleging abused her as a child. Well, I'll tell you, I'm expecting other people with other names coming forward from other parts of the country in the near future. Others have already done so and are with the police, large numbers of them. The scandal of historic child abuse in this country is going to be one of the defining issues of the next 5 years. It's going to corrode everything over this Parliament, because it is so large, it is so huge, it involves so many people. And just in my area, I have people come forward to me, a man kept as a slave, forced to work in a foundry, aged 11 to 16, kept as a slave.
That's John Mann MP speaking a couple of months ago. What are you, both of you, very quickly, your thoughts on this, Jerome? Is anything going to happen about this? I mean, we'll all be watching this programme 10:30 next Tuesday, but what do you think?
I mean, mixture of feelings. I mean, I think there clearly were some awful cover-ups, you know, through the 50s, 60s and 70s in this area. But at the same time, I think we need to be cautious that it doesn't turn into a witch hunt afterwards, and that the sort of good practice about evidence and people not being proven guilt, you know.
The problem is, there's a guy called Peter McKelvey who was a whistleblower. He's claims prompted Operation Fernbridge. He handed in the 1980s a massive dossier to Panorama. So let's see if they produce that next Tuesday. Well, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Green Councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas.
Thanks, Tony.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol.